Last Sunday evening, we were challenged by the teachings of Christ to commit ourselves to change wherever truth might dictate. And I urged us, and I ask you to encourage me to commit and recommit myself, and for you to commit yourself afresh to change wherever the will of God would dictate that we change. And I'm wondering if that was a permanent commitment on your part. I hope it was. I feel that we can assume that, because that is the basis for Christian discipleship. And it's based upon that that I'm asking you to consider with me for the next 2 or 3 weeks a subject that I think will call for change in the lives of almost all of us at a very practical level of our lives. And for the next 2 or 3 weeks, we'll be noticing this subject. And I want to use, by way of introduction, a glimpse into the Old Testament this morning. Several recent events and present conditions are calling all of us to focus our attention upon our material possessions and to make us re-examine what our responsibility as Christians should be to our material possessions. For example, OPEC, the oil-producing and exporting countries in the world, OPEC's irresponsible raising of prices for oil is causing a corresponding rise in inflation in America and in the world that in America reached beyond 13%, or right at 13% last year alone. Now that inflationary rate is causing us to again re-examine our material possessions. The general instability that exists in the world today, that is reflected in the circumstances in Iran, in Russia, and their expansion policies that are seen in Afghanistan and other places, the general instability of the world community in which we live is again causing us to re-examine our relationship to material possessions and to look at our responsibility in the use of them. In 1 Corinthians, the 7th chapter, I find a corresponding time in the life of Paul in the Roman Empire when Paul there in the 29th verse says, "The appointed time has grown very short. From now on, let those who have wives live as though they had none." And he goes on and points out some affairs and some instances in our personal lives that need to be re-examined. And he's putting these things more or less on hold because of the temporary nature and the instability of the times in which he was living. On down in verse 30, he says that those who buy ought to be like those who had no goods, and those who deal with the world as though they had no dealings with it. For the form of this world is passing away. Now, Paul was referring to an unstable time, a state of instability, during which Christians needed to re-examine their relationship to temporal, earthly, and material possessions. I think all of this that we've noticed in our own day, and coupled with that which we saw in Paul's day, I think all of it perhaps is being reflected in our present deficit in contributions in the college church. Our present deficit in the college church contribution is running about $800 a Sunday. That's over $3,000 a month that we're running behind in our budget. It's the first time that's ever happened, at least since I've been here, and I suspect that it's never happened really before. But it's making us look again at our material possessions and our responsibility regarding those possessions. Now, all of that sounds pretty dark. On the other hand, though, we have perhaps an unprecedented event in the contribution that was taken up for the Ballinger family, which in one Sunday amounted to about $23,000. And at this point, freely generously and joyfully in order to help a family meet a crisis in their lives. And we've done this so that we might fill in the void, at least in a material way, and help them meet some responsibilities and stand behind them. Now, that's tremendous. Now, all of that, to me, simply says that our giving is not a matter of our not having it, or at least our not giving. Our not giving is not a matter of our not having it, nor is it a matter of our not being willing to give it. But rather, I think it's a matter of priorities, and whether or not you and I, who at special times can show a generosity that perhaps is astonishing, can then, when the special time or the special need passes, can then revert to a condition of just simply not giving at all. Now, I don't mean that everybody in here has stopped giving, but I do know this, that whenever the need for a sermon on giving was presented, and I was asked to preach on it, I became aware of what I believe to be a true condition. I don't believe that one sermon on giving is going to answer the problem that we're faced with right now. I don't think that's going to solve it. I think what we need to do is get a real broad perspective of our responsibility toward our relation or toward our material possessions and look at some priorities. Because among the student body, and I'll just use you as an example, you'll not be the only example. I'll give myself and others also later. But among our student body, many in this congregation responded generously. Clubs contributed hundreds of dollars. Students took money from their very purses and probably gave all that they had. And simply we compounded our power and gave financially in a way that alleviated the problem for this lovely family. And yet, these very people, you students, bless your hearts, having met that immediate need, you will then allow from then on, it seems, the plate to just pass by in front of you, and you don't give anything. Now, not all of you do that. But there's a significant amount of you who just simply every Sunday are not giving a red cent that is causing the work of this congregation to be put in hard times. And it's not that you don't know that we depend on you. You know that. We're depending upon the student power to give in order to meet this church's budget. We can't do it without you. Now, I don't know whether that makes you feel good or feel bad, but I'm just simply telling you like it is. We can't do without your financial contributions to take care of the general needs that are, they're universal in one sense. We send them all over the world, and they are perpetual. They are every Sunday we have these needs. They have to be met. People are depending upon us. So it seems to me like that we need to re-examine our priorities and see if perhaps there's a whole total way of life that the early church engaged in that perhaps we've missed. I'm wondering if there's not a way of looking at material possessions that we've never really and truly taken under consideration as we should have. And I want us then for the next few weeks to investigate the standard of sharing practiced by the first century church. And I'm going to do this in block form. I mean by that, we're going to do it Sunday morning and Sunday night for about 3 weeks. Now, that means that in order to get this full picture, you'll have to come back Sunday nights as well as be here on Sunday mornings. Now, if that's an imposition, then you need to ask yourself the question whether or not a clearer understanding of your material possessions and your responsibility toward them is really material, or that's another word, don't want to use that, is really apropos and appropriate and is really important. Whenever we find the judgment scene being described by the Lord, He described it in terms of what we did with our material possessions. So I think that we'll study it in block form in order to condense it and in order to emphasize it and eliminate other things so that it will not take up our attention. Now, before we do that, or as we do it, as we began to do it, I want you to see something that relates to the Old Testament. In order to establish the framework in which we're going to view the New Testament practice of sharing, we're going to have to go back into the Old Testament and get there a framework or a structure in which we can view the New Testament practice. We're going to have to look at the Old Testament practice in order to get the background in which the New Testament church actually did their contributing and their sharing. Now, do you understand what I'm saying? In order to understand what the New Testament practice was, we'll have to go back into the Old Testament and get the historical background. And then we'll be able to put a framework around the New Testament practice and understand it. Now, in the light of what has been said there, as we examine the Old Testament practice, we see a detailed legal economic structure that was put into force by God through the law of Moses for the purpose of safeguarding the economic balance between the rich and the poor. Now you say, what in the world did you say? And that may have been such a long sentence you didn't grasp it. I'm simply saying that whenever you go back and look in the Old Testament, we see a very detailed legal economic structure that was placed there on the people and was to work itself out among the people for the purpose of safeguarding the balance between the rich and the poor. Now, there are always going to be rich folks, and there are always going to be poor folks. Jesus said it. The Old Testament said it. But what the Old Testament did was to make it so that there was not an ever-increasing disparity between the rich and the poor. That it kept bringing them back down to where, once again, they could go at it again, and some would become rich and others would become poorer. But every so often, he'd bring them back and he would help them to try to balance the economics of their day so that there would not be a vast disparity between the rich and the poor, the haves and the have-nots. For example, there was the normal provision made for charity. Now, I'm going to ask you to turn to two or three places. Turn to Leviticus, the 19th chapter. And let's notice, first of all, just the everyday, run-of-the-mill provisions made for charity among the Jewish people. There was what was called the gleanings principle. Gleanings. Look in Leviticus 19, verses 9 and 10. When you reap the harvest of your land, you shall not reap your field to its very border, neither shall you gather the gleanings after your harvest. And you shall not strip your vineyard bare, neither shall you gather the fallen grapes of your vineyard. You shall leave them for the poor and for the sojourner. I am the Lord your God. Now he bound this upon them, upon his own authority. He said, don't just glean right up against the fence. You leave some of that for the poor. And when you gather your grapes, don't gather all of them, and don't pick up what falls on the ground. You leave that for the poor and for the sojourner. So these gleanings were to be left for the poor and for the sojourner. In the book of Ruth, chapter 2, when Ruth and Naomi came back from Moab, they survived principally because of the fact that this principle was being adhered to in the Old Testament economy. Naomi sent Ruth out to glean among the reapers of Boaz, and so that's the way they lived. And she'd bring this sack full of grain home, and they would live off of that. And you'll see that practice being demonstrated there in the second chapter of the book of Ruth. But not only was that true, every 3 years, a tithe of all the produce was to be set aside, brought into the towns, and was to be put in a common storehouse so that the Levites and the poor, the fatherless, and the needy could be given their store out of that common storehouse. Look at Deuteronomy, the 14th chapter, in verse 28. Deuteronomy 14, beginning in verse 28. Now, this is the second principle. The first was the gleaning principle that took care of them just year by year. They had access to the fields to go out and glean in these fields, the poor did. The second principle was that every 3 years, the tithe, or one-tenth of all the produce, was to be set aside for the poor and was to be gathered in their towns. Look at verse 28 now, Deuteronomy 14. At the end of every 3 years, you shall bring forth all the tithe of your produce in the same year and lay it up within your towns. And the Levite, because he has no portion or inheritance with you, and the sojourner, the fatherless and the widow who are within your towns shall come and eat and be filled, that the Lord your God may bless you in all the work of your hands that you do. You see what they were doing there? Every 3 years, one-tenth would be put aside so that there would be a common storehouse that the poor and the sojourner and the Levites could come and take their substance out of that common storehouse. Now, this was what we might call charity. And it represents something what like, I guess, the social welfare state that we're engaged in now. But you know what charity tends to produce in people? Charity, perpetual charity, tends to produce what in people? Irresponsibility. If all they do is draw, just go and put out their hand without working, without whatever, it tends to produce a state of irresponsibility. And that wasn't all that the Old Testament provided, because I suppose God knew that. There was a second thing that the Old Testament law provided, and that was a legal provision for what you might call justice. A legal provision for what might be called justice. And there were two of these things at least. Notice, if you will. One was the sabbatical year. The sabbatical year. Now, remember, what you might have called just charity carried them through year by year, and then every 3 years, just kind of was the day-to-day getting along, charity. But then the sabbatical year interrupted that and gave a new opportunity. This law provided for the liberation of the soil. It provided for the liberation of all slaves. It provided for the cancellation of all debts. Every 7 years this happened. Notice, if you will, look at Exodus 23, verses 10 and 11, and watch how the sabbatical law freed the soil every 7 years. For 6 years you shall sow your land. That's Exodus 23:10. For 6 years you shall sow your land and gather in its yield. But the seventh year you shall let it lie rest and lie fallow, that the poor of your people may eat, and what you leave the wild beasts may eat. You shall do likewise with your vineyard and with your olive orchard. Now that was every seventh year. After gathering, after planting and gathering 6 years, then there was just to be a lay-by. You weren't to plant, you weren't to harvest, you weren't to plow, you were just to let it lie there. For the land's sake, I gather also, but also for a humanitarian reason. He says it's so the poor people can have access to that whole harvest for that year. They just go in there and eat whatever they want to eat, and you're not to harvest it that year. That was the sabbatical release of the land. But look again. Every 7 years, Hebrew slaves also receive their freedom. Look at Deuteronomy, the 15th chapter. Deuteronomy 15. Beginning in verse 12 through about 15. Listen to what it says. If your brother, a Hebrew man or a Hebrew woman, is sold to you, he shall serve you 6 years. And in the seventh year, you shall let him go free from you. And when you let him go free from you, you shall not let him go empty-handed. You shall furnish him liberally out of your flock, out of your threshing floor, and out of your wine press. As the Lord your God has blessed you, you shall give to him. See what that says? Occasionally, I say occasionally, I suspect it was probably a common thing, circumstances outside the control of the persons involved would cause these people to have to hire out to one of their brother Hebrews. And they wouldn't be able to meet their needs or their own needs, whether through whatever, through the death of a breadwinner or through some kind of a catastrophe that might have happened. They would have to go to work for somebody else and just simply hire out to them in the form of a slave. Now, that was all right. God didn't object to that kind of dealing with people. But he said it's only to be temporary. At the end of 6 years, having done that for 6 years, then all Hebrew slaves were to go free. You were not to keep them any longer. You were to benefit from their work for 6 years? Fine. Go and do it. If he calls upon you, fine. But in the seventh year, you're to let that person go free. And he said, furthermore, you're not to send him out with nothing. Why? Well, because he didn't want to perpetuate what had happened. He wanted to send the fellow out stocked up, ready to go out and produce. He said, you're to send him out with flocks. You're to send him out with grain. You're to send him out with the wine from your wine presses. You're to load him down. He says, give him liberally. Just like God has given to you, you give to that slave as you send him out. Don't you send him out empty. All right. Now, then the third principle was that all debts were canceled every 7 years. All debts were canceled every 7 years. If you borrowed $5,000 from someone, when the seventh year came, the debt was just canceled. And you know, God, looking into the human nature, said, now be careful. He said, if somebody comes to you on down toward the seventh year and says, I need to borrow some money, don't you look at this when this, you know, why you just got a year to pay it back, and then you say, no, I'm not gonna give it. He said, don't you act ugly. That's about what he said. Don't you be like that. If a brother needs some money, I don't care if it's just 6 months until the seventh year begins. He said, you give him the money that he needs. Every seventh year, there was the cancellation of every debt. Look at Deuteronomy, the 15th chapter, verses 1 through 6. Same chapter. Oh, about 1 through 3, or 1 through 2, really. At the end of every 7 years, you shall grant a release. And this is the manner of the release. Every creditor shall release what he has lent to his neighbor. He shall not exact it of his neighbor, his brother, because the Lord's release has been proclaimed. My! You see what he's doing? Every 7 years. All right, let's back up just a bit now. Every year, the poor would get to go in and glean among the harvests of the rich. They'd get to go in and get what they needed. And then every 3 years, there was a storehouse prepared in every town so that these who were poor, the sojourners and the Levites, could come in there and get what they needed. And then every 7th year, the soil was made to lie fallow. Every Hebrew slave was turned loose and set free with a big, bountiful harvest of his own that he had gathered there in working for somebody else. And then all debts were to be canceled every 7 years. That's just amazing that was to be done like that. All right. Now, there was one other great big principle. The one we've just been talking about was the sabbatical year. Every 7 years, something was to happen. The land was to lie fallow. The slaves were to be released. And all debts were to be canceled. Now, that was the sabbatical principle. Now, there was another one, though, another major principle. And that was called the year of Jubilee. The year of Jubilee. Do you know how many years... How often did the year of Jubilee come? Huh? Every 50 years. The year of Jubilee came every 50 years, and what it represented was the sabbatical of years. You see, there were 7 cycles. 7 cycles of 7 years would be how many? Be 49 years, you see. Well, then in the year after the 49th year, there was to be what was known as the year of Jubilee. What happened on the year of Jubilee? All of this that happened at the other times, too, happened. The land lay fallow, all the slaves were released, all debts were canceled, but then one major difference was this: all of the property that had been sold by one Hebrew to another one because of hard times or whatever may have been the case, all property reverted to its original owners every 50 years. Interesting. Every 50 years, God came in a sense said, okay, we're going to start over. Now, God, if you'll notice, was not against private ownership. It's just the opposite. God was so much in favor of private ownership that he wanted to let everybody have a go at it. Because your great-great-grandpappy might have been lazy. Here you are, in about the 49th year, you know, of this thing, your great-great-grandpappy or your great-grandpappy might have been lazy and just kind of lollygagged around and was a playboy. And so, by the way, he lost his property. He couldn't produce. He couldn't live. And he said, look, I'll sell you my property. Okay, fine. Where does that put you? It puts you in a perpetual state of being in bondage to somebody else unless there's some balancing act that's done in order to give you a chance to be a private owner of property. And that's what God did. It's beautiful. Every 50 years, the land reverted to the owner, and that land had been given to them, you know, by God through Joshua when they came into the land of Canaan. It was given to the families, and each family had his own portion of land. And sometimes, through hardship, through the death of the breadwinner, or through some other circumstance that may or may not have lay within the control of the people that it affected, the land was lost and it went to somebody else. That's all right. But it was only to be temporary. Every 50 years, it was to be reverted back to its original owner. An interesting thing. Turn over, if you will, to Leviticus, the 25th chapter, in verses 10 through 13. Leviticus 25. Verses 10 through about 12. Listen to this. You shall hallow the 50th year and proclaim liberty throughout the land to all its inhabitants. It shall be a jubilee for you, when each of you shall return to his property. And each of you shall return to his family. That had reference to being a slave there. But each of you returning to his property had to do with this, once again, this distribution of property. Verse 11. A jubilee shall be the 50th year to you. In it you shall neither sow nor reap what it grows of itself, nor gather the grapes from the undressed vines. For it is a jubilee, it shall be holy to you. You shall eat what it yields out of the field. Then verse 13. In this year of jubilee, each of you shall return to his property. Now that was a law of God. It was a law that regulated their economy. And it was a law which, in effect, had the tendency to break down the disparity between the rich and the poor. And it gave everybody a chance every 50 years to prove whether or not he could be a good steward of what God had given him. And probably, when that 50 years came and everybody's land went back to each original owner or each original family, I don't doubt but what the poor started getting poorer again. They started losing it. And the rich started getting richer again. And that's just the difference in the talents that God has given us. Some people have it and some don't. Some can make it and some can't. And sure enough, about every 7 years, there had to be a wiping of the slate partially. And then every 50th year, there had to be a wiping of the slate completely. Well, you say, what right? Why did he do that? Let me tell you why he did it. Look at verse 23 of chapter 25. Upon what basis did Jehovah do such as that? Verse 23 says, the land shall not be sold in perpetuity. The word perpetuity means in permanence. It cannot be sold permanently. It cannot be sold in perpetuity. For the land is mine. In other words, all you do is rent it. He was telling these Hebrew people, it isn't your land to sell. You're just renting it from me. It's my land. And I can do what I want to with it. And I choose every 50 years to let it go back to the original owners. Now look back up in verses 15 through 17. During this 50-year period, people would sell land back and forth. You know, he'd sell it to him, and then somebody else would buy it from somebody else. And here we go, we got this. How are they to gauge the value of that land? Look at verse 15. According to the number of years after the Jubilee, you shall buy from your neighbor. And according to the number of years for crops, he shall sell to you. If the number of years are many, you shall increase the price. And if the years are few, you shall diminish the price. For it is the number of the crops that you're selling. If the Jubilee was, say, just five years away, and you wanted to sell your land, well, it wouldn't bring much because it only had five crops on it, you know, that could be sold. Or if there was a 45-year wait before the year of Jubilee, you could get a good price for that land because there were 45 years of harvest there. But the point was, he said, you're not actually selling the land, you're selling the use of it, and the land, he says, belongs to God. Now, what's all this, why am I saying all this? Just simply this. God was concerned about the physical well-being of his people in the same way, but he was as concerned about the physical well-being as he was about the spiritual well-being. I'm not sure that's true either. How would you say it? He was concerned both about their physical well-being and their spiritual well-being. And he just simply put into legislation certain safeguards that would keep the division between the rich and the poor from ever widening wider and wider and wider. He just simply says every 7 years there's going to be a complete wiping of the slate. We're going to start all over. Every 50 years there'll be a total wiping of the slate with the land involved included. And then down to the very every year we're going to see to it that everyone gets what they need in order to get along in life. Now that is the legal, economic set up in the old covenant that provides us with the historical background into which the New Testament practice of sharing is to be regarded. And we're going to see some of that tonight. Tonight we're going to notice Jesus' lifestyle and his teachings that must be viewed in the light of what we've just noticed this morning. But that'll get us an introduction to it, and it'll kind of start us off. This morning during the first service, I had been wondering, how am I going to relate this subject this morning and offer an invitation? And I didn't come up with the answer until I was standing here about to give it, and then I thought, well, this Jubilee principle is exactly what God has done for us spiritually. That's it. How would you like to have to pay back all that you owe God? Well, don't talk to me about that. I can't pay it, Lord. I can't pay it back. Okay, he says, I'm just going to wipe the slate clean. I'm going to declare all slaves free. And if you just simply will come to me through my son, I'm going to mark all your debts paid. There won't be anything outstanding against you. That's this Jubilee principle in a spiritual sense. And that's what he's asking that you do today. He's offering to you the release that was characteristic of the Jubilee principle economically, and now he offers it to you spiritually. He says, it's just, you know, I'm going to revert you to your former state of innocence or to your former state of being forgiven. I'm not going to hold it against you. Today, you may be here and you may have some real burdens and some real debts that you just feel like, I cannot pay that. God, just, I can't pay him back. Well, you don't have to. Thank God for his way of just wiping slates clean. Come to me, all you that labor and are heavy laden, and I'll give you rest, Jesus said. The Lord said through Isaiah,
Come, let us reason together, says the Lord. Though your sins be as scarlet, they'll be as white as snow. Though they be as red as crimson, they'll be as white as wool. That's God's prerogative, and He chooses to do it.